Welcome back to the Crashed Upon Podcast. It is a Sunday, a rare Sunday edition of the pod, January 19th. Some might even call it, in the comments, a late edition of the pod. I delayed our pod today a little bit by 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Because I had to wolf down some dinner. Shame on me for that.
Yep. Shame on you for deciding that you should eat before this show.
But yeah,
Sunday. Yeah. There was at one point in time that we did all Sunday episodes, I think. Am I misremembering?
Yeah. Sunday used to be our day, and then Monday became our day, and then Tuesday became our day. We've just like progressively strayed from the light, essentially.
And now we're just all over the place.
I wouldn't mind Sunday becoming a fixture.
I'd be fine with Sunday becoming the fixture again. I think the main issue and the reason why we moved away from it was, I think it was COVID when we did it, and there weren't really a bunch of Sunday games, whereas the Ducks play their 5 p.m. Sunday games typically.
Yeah, I honestly forget. I forget. It's a blur. Yep. This podcast is like almost a decade old.
We're getting there.
I mean, the podcast started in 2017, and it is now 2025.
It is.
We are dangerously close to being almost a decade old.
I always say this, we have yet to cover a playoff win.
Yeah, we are 0 for the pod. 0 for multiple pods, because we used to be the Anaheim Calling pod, at rest in peace.
Yep.
So as you can tell, we're waffling, we're delaying, because the Ducks really gave us a nice treat this week. And what I mean by that is that nothing really changed. Nothing really changed. They completed their road trip. It ended up being a 1-4-1 road trip. They lost, I think they've played 3 games since we last recorded.
Yep.
Washington, Tampa, Florida. And they scored 3 goals in those games. They were shut out in 2 out of 3. They had some better moments. You know, they managed to make it competitive against the Lightning. And I thought that they looked okay at times against Florida. But in general, nothing has really changed in our kind of bigger picture view of the team. So what we're going to do today, a little different. We're going to bounce around, because there's only so many episodes we can do saying fire Greg Cronin, everything is bad. I think that that's been the podcast for like 3 weeks in a row now.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is we're going to bounce around a couple different little items.
Okay.
We'll get into some questions. We'll let it flow. We'll enter a flow state. And then from there, we will just see how things go.
One thing I do want to mention really quickly, just about this team in general.
It's
something that you brought up, actually, in, I don't remember if it was text message or Discord, but that shots on goal in general, you may have been planning to bring this up anyways, but shots on goal in general are down throughout the league. Mm-hmm. And the Ducks have this like hyper focus on offense, and that they need to shoot more pucks and get more towards that and all this different type of stuff. And so one of the things that I thought was interesting kind of looking at the numbers is their shots on goal total puts them kind of right on par with their expected goal total. They're 24th in the league in shots on goal per game, and about 24th in the league also in expected goals for per game or per 60. What's interesting to me is just this hyperfixation on that from Greg Cronin, and that passing up shots when, and this is more, I guess, kind of before we get into all your topics, this kind of goes to more of the same about Cronin, and I think he just needs to be relieved of his duties at this point. But this hyperfixation on that kind of, I think you're missing the whole issue with this team, which is the fact of, well, yes, like, sure, maybe they should shoot the puck more, but getting cross-ice passes to get a high-danger look, I'll gladly take that over a shot from far out wide. The main issue is just the amount of shots they're facing against, and it's hard to get good looks for when you're constantly spending a game in your own zone defending. And that is, I think, one thing that's not talked enough about with this team, which is just their failure at defensive acumen. Like, shots on goal against per 60, they are 31st in the league. And that lines up almost perfectly with expected goals against, where they are 32nd in the league. It's them and the Sharks as being 31st and 32nd, flip-flopping with shots on goal against and expected goals against. And it's really hard to generate a lot of offense and get your shots for when you're spending so much time defending. And so I think one of my overall frustrations with this team, with how it's talked about, with how the coach talks about it, there's this hyper focus, and I get it when you're getting shut out in two of three games on the offensive side of the puck, and from his side of it, this passing up of shot opportunities. But the bigger focus should be on the defensive side of the puck and how that is limiting your ability to create offense, because they are inextricably linked. And so if you are spending most of the game defending, you are not going to be able to create offense that much. And I think that that is not something that's talked about enough. It's papered over by a lot of people stating, well, the Ducks are better defensively. They're not. They just straight up aren't. And that is something that really does need to be talked about a whole lot more by the team, by a lot of people around the team, and everything like that.
Wow, inextricably.
Did you like that one?
You pulled that one out of your beanie.
Uh-huh.
So for those who... Wow, oh my God. This visual. So for those who can't see, we're listening via audio mediums. Jake is wearing a beanie on the pod, which is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also sipping a glass of white wine.
Yeah.
What a visual that is.
What a treat.
What a treat that is. Good for you. Honestly, good for you. Live your best life. I support you. But that is really amusing. Yes, to your point, I do think that the Ducks and Greg Cronin love to talk about getting shots on net. Shots on net, pucks on net, everything to the net. And they've been saying this since basically day one of the season. This is nothing new. But as the season has progressed, that hasn't really yielded any sort of consistent offense. It's yielded below average offense, and we'll get to the defending part of it. But I think that what that kind of hints at, to me at least, is that it's much easier to say shoot everything on net, throw everything on net, than it is to say and to figure out, how do we create more dangerous opportunities? How do we get to the front of the net? How do we get one-time mm-hmm. shots from the slot? How do we get cross-ice passes? How do we create offense that's going to be both repeatable and dangerous? And yeah, I guess you could argue that throwing pucks on net and trying to create rebounds and stuff like that is one way of doing that. And if you look at the Carolina Hurricanes, they've played in that way. But if you look at the personnel of this team, it's clear that they have the talent to play a more nuanced, a more refined style of offensive hockey. And they just, the coach doesn't seem to have any ideas on how to accomplish that. And I think that that's really troubling. And then, yes, you peel back the layers even more. You talk about their own zone, and then it gets even worse, because they're spending so much time defending. They're so gassed in their own end that then they can't go the other way and create stuff in transition. So it all works together. But you are going to get your offensive opportunities regardless at some point in the game. And they just sure. they just are not capable right now. I shouldn't say they're not capable, but they don't seem to have any ideas or any answers for how to be more dangerous and more effective than just throw pucks on net. And I mean, that's pretty emblematic of this whole season for me.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So a couple things that I wanted to hit on about just the last week.
Yep.
Isaac Lundestrom suffers a pretty bad knee-on-knee collision against the Florida Panthers and left the game, looked pretty bad. He wasn't putting any weight on that leg. He didn't come back in the game, right?
No, he did not.
And so do we have any update on his status?
I don't think I've seen anything. I don't think the Ducks have put out anything, but I'll double check right now.
Yeah, I don't think they've put anything out. The Ducks will be back at home at Honda Center on the 21st, so on Tuesday.
Yep.
And so we'll probably have a better idea by then. But
I think we'll have an idea by tomorrow. So by the time you're listening to this, there probably will be some information out there.
Oh, there's a practice. Yeah, that's right.
There's a practice tomorrow. So most likely Derek will probably get some information on it.
That's true. So we'll find out if there's any sort of timeline, but I think he'll be out a little while, right? I mean, that looked pretty bad. We don't know how long it'll be. My question now is this. With Isaac Lundestrom out, we don't necessarily know how close Trevor Zegras is. He didn't travel with the team, I don't think. What are the lines going to look like? Because now you have an opening there that is kind of, it feels like a pretty big opening to maybe get a little creative and change up the lines a little bit. So let's assume that Zegras is back in the next week. What should the lines look like? How can you draw this up for us?
So are we saying Zegras is not back and we're creating the lines without that?
Let's start with just without Zegras, and then once Zegras comes back. Okay. So we'll do two versions.
So it's difficult because I think the easy option here, right, is you slot Mason McTavish in the center role where Isaac Lindstrom was at, and you put Sam Colangelo back in the lineup, play him with Leo Carlson and Alex Killorn. And I think that's the easy answer in the sense of that McTavish, Gauthier, Fabry was the line already. Like, these were kind of the lines that were there. And it was the major tweaks that happened that caused them to do McTavish with Carlson. Having said that, I would not go that easy route. Because I think that what we've seen is that McTavish with Carlson is working. Like, maybe they didn't have the best game against the Panthers, but they clearly had some chemistry, especially against the Lightning. They looked like the best line for the Stux team. In an ideal world, you know, I'm just going to go in my ideal world putting together this lineup. I would put Troy Terry with them.
With Carlson and McTavish?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I think the Strome, Vetrano, Terry line, just it's run its course. It's still a solid enough line. It's not a top line for this team. The numbers have really gone down. They are giving up more expected goals against than they are getting some for. They are about even in terms of goals for and goals against. So they're giving up as much as they are getting. So even if they are generating offense, they're giving it up at the same exact rate. So I would break that up and really try to get Troy Terry with other guys that can really elevate him and go or help. He can help elevate and can also help elevate him. So I would start there and put those three guys together. And then I think you just, at this point, have to keep Strome and Vetrano together and just probably try to limit them and play in lower minutes and put maybe Cutter Gauthier with them, maybe playing on his off wing in that situation. Or you could go the easy route of throwing Alex Killorn with them.
Do you also have to call up a forward at this point?
No, because Sam Colangelo.
Okay, that's right.
Honestly, here's the experimentation that I think you would agree with. Mm-hmm. Put Cutter Gauthier at center.
You beat me to it.
That's where you were going, and that's why you asked this question.
Actually, no, I did not. That's not why I asked it. I was just trying to figure. I was literally like figuring it out as you were talking. But I think that the place where the Ducks are at, they're pretty much out of the playoffs. I think that they basically shot themselves in the foot with this road trip, and it feels like now the meaningful games stage is, I mean, at best, it's fading. But realistically, it's probably over.
They're 9 points out at this point. 9 points out with 1, 2, 3, 4 teams ahead of them in the playoff race.
But if you just wanted to go a little crazy, a little devilish, you could just keep the Strom line together, keep the Carlson line together, and go with a Frankenstein third line of Colangelo and Fabry on the wings and Gauthier at center.
Yeah.
And just try that. Why the hell not? I mean, Cutter Gauthier hasn't taken faceoffs this season, at least
beyond. He comes in every once in a while, but
yeah. But he was a center in college last year. You know, we saw him more as a winger in the NHL, but the way that his game has really evolved this season, especially the way that he's become so responsible defensively, I think you might as well give him a shot at center. And I think that him next to Colangelo, those two guys could be really good together. I mean, it just kind of makes sense. Colangelo is kind of a north-south type player, but has the ability to see plays developing east-west. He's got a good shot. And then, I mean, Robbie Fabry's got to play with someone, so you put him there.
I guess here's an idea. Would you rather do it like that, or would you rather put Troy Terry with those two, keep Alex Killorn with McTavish and Carlson, and then you do Vetrano, Strome, Fabry?
I think, yeah, ideally you would do something like that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be somewhat realistic, even though there's no way this line actually happens, but I just... If you keep the Strome line together, that's what I think I would do. But yeah, you're right that you could just put Terry with Colangelo and Gauthier and see how that goes.
I figured out what's going to happen. Brett Leeson's going to come in and play center on that line.
Oh, I forgot about Brett Leeson. But
I did too.
Brett Leeson shouldn't. I mean, Brett Leeson can play on the fourth line instead of Ross Johnston. I mean, that's fine.
I think more realistically, you're going to have Brett Leeson come in on that line, and maybe, if anything, Sam Colangelo come in on the fourth line.
Well, Brett Leeson has played center this season, so he seems like next in line. But this is what I would do. Neither of us expect Greg Cronin to put Cutter Gauthier at center. That is just not going to happen. But this is what we would do. Realistically, like you said, Leeson probably comes in. My only worry, going back to our hypothetical, which is more fun and interesting to me, is if you put Terry, Colangelo, Gauthier together, I love the idea of that line, and I think it would be really fun. How do you feel about a third line of Vetrano, Strom, Fabry? How does that make you feel?
If they're playing in actual third line minutes, that is the key, then it's fine.
They might get annihilated.
But if they are playing 18, 19 minutes a night, like Vetrano and Strom have been, I do not like it at all.
Those are your three worst defensive forwards on the team.
Yes.
And you're putting them on the same line.
And like, here's the thing. If you're putting them on the same line, playing them in a third line role where they're protected, not playing against the higher end players of the other team, it could be a beneficial situation for all of them playing together because they're not going to have those hard matchups like Strom and Vetrano were getting. Because I think we saw Strom, Vetrano, Terry work because they weren't keyed in on as much by other teams with the higher end lines. It's once they started getting those matchups was when their numbers really started to plummet. So I think Strom and Vetrano like have been better this season than years past. It's just the matchups haven't really been favorable to them as the season has gone on, and they really just shouldn't be in this role that they're in. And so while, yes, I think Fabry is the weak link, I'd rather have someone else there. I'd probably rather have Brett Leeson there than Robbie Fabry. But, I'd also rather have Colangelo or a whole host of other players there.
Right.
But I think that I'm fine with that line overall as long as they're being used in that role.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing with third lines now in the NHL is that they still have to be able to add some value to your team.
I think Strom and Vetrano can in that role, though. I guess that's my point.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing with Vetrano is that he does play that kind of really checking style, he chases after pucks, he gets shots on net. Strom can be a smart player. Fabry loves to chase after the puck and get shots off. Fabry is just like a worse version of Vetrano. It is so 100%. Hilarious. It is so hilarious. Also, I let a tweet go a couple games ago where I just ripped Robbie Fabry and then he scored in the same game-tying
goal.
That's why tweeting live during games is not always the best choice. It's not always the best time to air your grievances. But
Open yourself up to freezing cold takes.
But realistically, I think you're right. Leeson probably plays center. I would just love to at least just experiment with Cutter Gauthier at center. You probably don't have to even do it that for that long because Trevor Zegras is...
He may be back on Tuesday.
I mean, we're at 6 weeks, right?
Yeah. Tuesday is highly possible that he's back. Like, I think him not traveling maybe was through caution, but he likely has been skating. I mean, he took part in full practices before the road trip.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's think about the lineup with Trevor Zegras in it, because
I think you just dropped Zegras into that to where Lundestrom was at. Like I had this pet theory when these lineups came out, when they moved McTavish to wing, that while Lundestrom was there just because I think Cronin likes him, I think that they maybe viewed this as where Zegras would slot in. That you move McTavish to the wing to have Zegras play center again. And you had Zegras and Gauthier and Killorn playing really well together. And you also had Zegras and Fabry play together to not great results, but you had them play together. And so maybe you think of having Zegras, Gauthier, Fabry as a line once Trevor Zegras comes back.
So that is your prediction?
That is my pet theory as to some of the logic behind these line changes. So yes, that is my prediction for what they would do.
I mean, if this is the current setup, so Vetrano, Strom, Terry, McTavish, Carlson, Killorn, and then Gauthier, Zegras, Fabry, I don't hate that at all.
Swap Fabry and Terry, and I'm happy.
Here's my approach. You want to hear my lines?
Okay, this is your just like if you're the head coach making the lines, because this to be clear, this is what I think they're gonna do, not necessarily what I would do.
Yeah, that's why I asked you. Is this your prediction?
Yeah, Mighty Flow Hockey and both Miguel Gutierrez chime in saying Thursday is 6 week mark.
So we're right there. He's going to be back anytime now. Okay, here's my top six. The top six is really what I care about, and then I just don't care about the rest. But first line, McTavish, Carlson. So keeping McTavish in the wing, Troy Terry.
Okay.
So I want those three together. And then Gauthier, Zegras, Killorn, reunite them. That is the Ducks' best line this season. They only played like seven games together, but that is their best line. I want to see those guys together. And then third line, Vetrano, Strom, Colangelo. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that that's a perfect spot for Colangelo. And then fourth line doesn't really matter. Fabry, Harkins, and then take your pick of Nestorenko, Leeson, Johnston. I mean, it just doesn't matter, really. But your thoughts on my lineup?
That's probably what I would do. I mean, the only swap that maybe you could make is maybe you swap Killorn and Terry there. But I don't have an issue either way with that. I think Colangelo with Strome and Vetrano makes a whole lot more sense than Fabry from the long-term view of this team. And then the fourth line is just the fourth line. But I think both of our issues with a Strome, Vetrano, Fabry line is the Fabry part of it. I think we can talk ourselves into Vetrano and Strome potentially being solid enough third liners. It's the Fabry part of that, which is why why adding a Colangelo there, where maybe you could argue maybe Fabry's better than Colangelo if you wanted to make that argument for whatever reason. Sure. But at least with Colangelo, there is growth there. There's long-term outlook, a long-term view for this team and development that you could have there. And so I just think the pros outweigh the cons of having a younger Sam Colangelo there with Vetrano and Strome. And also from the perspective of, like, this Ducks team has really identified Vetrano and Strome as being leaders on this team. Mm-hmm. Like, Vetrano getting an extension, Ryan Strome has had the A on his jersey. By all accounts, they're really good locker room guys, all that type of stuff. Like, those are guys that you want your young guys playing with if that's how you view them. Like, that is, from a development perspective, what you want.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think Colangelo, I mean, the little bit that he's played recently, he's looked good every time. I mean, when he got to play with Carlson, he got a bunch of scoring chances. And I thought that what was really fascinating when he played with Carlson is that he actually kept up with him. Like, he was making plays as well, which I didn't really expect, because in my head, I've pigeonholed Sam Colangelo as kind of a bottom six type, but there's this play that keeps sticking out in my mind, which I posted the clip of on Twitter, where he comes in down the wing and he's got, I think it was Killorn on the opposite wing. And there's a bunch of pressure on him. He could have easily just chipped the puck in and go chase after it, but he waits just an extra split second and he fires off a cross ice pass, puts it into an area for Killorn to get, and then they're able to get a scoring chance as a result of that. And that split second presence of mind and vision, I mean, that's high level. That is something that not every player can do. And so I think that if you put him with a Strome, with a Vetrano, he can play off of those guys, and he can play that simple game and maybe even get some more shooting opportunities. But to circle back to the top six, though, I think that your point on swapping Terry and Killorn is interesting. We haven't talked about it yet, but we will. But I think I've just long wanted to see Terry with Carlson.
Agreed.
Because I just think that there's potential there. But I got to say, I have liked McTavish with Carlson and Killorn, and I do think that right now the way Carlson plays, it's so dependent on him getting the puck through the neutral zone and being kind of that driver and being the one that's always kind of carrying the puck. And I almost wonder if maybe Terry takes away from that a little bit. And maybe that defeats that. But we don't know, because we don't know how it would play out. So
and one of the really interesting things, I think, with Mason McTavish being there is that Mason McTavish kind of coming to the season, it felt like the best asset that he had, or maybe this was when he was drafted is what I'm thinking back to. But one of his best assets that he had was puck transition of the puck, movement of the puck from the defensive zone to the offensive zone. But I think what we've seen this season specifically is that that's kind of one of the weaker parts of his game this season, at least, where he gets caught with the puck on a stick and he's not really moving it in the best way ever. And really where he's more dangerous is feeding off of someone else and getting out into transition out in into the middle of the ice without the puck on a stick. And that leads to all this kind of really feeling like he would be better at wing, where he's not the one being relied upon moving that puck, of transporting that puck from the defensive zone to the offensive zone. He can really feed off that guy and play in a support role, get open for those looks, and then also get in and cause a little bit of disruption with his stick and create turnovers. And we saw that with the goal that Carlson ended up scoring in Tampa Bay, where he's able to get in, cause a turnover, get the puck, and make a move to Carlson. And I also kind of think back a little bit to, I don't think it was this past summer, but the summer before, when we had Mitch Brown on and we had this kind of overarching conversation about Zegras and McTavish. And this was at the peak of, like, Zegras is going to move to wing, McTavish is the center, all this type of stuff. And Mitch had a really nuanced take about it all, that Trevor Zegras is what the guy you want at center, because he's the guy that needs the puck on a stick, that moves that puck out of the zone, that is so creative that you limit his ability to be creative when the puck isn't on his stick as much. And that's the biggest thing with being a center, is the puck's going to be on your stick more to create those plays. Whereas McTavish is the person that can create the one-touch passes off the boards and can get out and isn't as reliant as of having the puck on a stick to get to dangerous areas. And that was something he said year and a half ago at this point, before kind of this has happened. And it really just rings true when you see Mason McTavish playing on the wing, that his game, especially playing with a high-end center, really, really sits a lot better there.
Yeah, I mean, we might as well just dive into it. I mean, unless you have anything else in the lines, you know.
No,
real
quick, I want to ask you this, because Smile RL brings this up, and I think that this could be a good point, because it's something we see a lot. But he's saying, do you guys like Killorn a lot? I almost feel like he's not really doing much. And Killorn's a player, I think, that you and I usually aren't really harsh on. We aren't really critical of, because,
well, especially compared to how he's talked about on social media.
And that was where I was going to go with this, because I think you and I both think he's been fine. He's not playing worth his contract, because he's just not producing at that level, but he's not to the level, he's not playing as poorly as everyone out there kind of wants to make him out to be. I think he's been a perfectly fine top six player for this team. Maybe fringe top six is probably the better way to put it. But he's not this negative asset for this team overall. And so I guess to answer that question, what do you think he's doing out there that people are missing?
Well, I think that one thing he does really well that is not going to show up on the stat sheet is he is so good at getting pucks off the wall and protecting the puck, holding up, waiting for someone to join him, finding them, getting them the puck, and just kind of keeping possessions alive. There's a lot of plays where the Ducks are cycling down low and Killorn uses his frame to either muscle a guy off the puck or to protect the puck. And when you have guys like Leo Carlson or even Mason McTavish who are quicker, who are more skilled, having a guy who's just kind of like a hub who can just keep things going, keep things alive, and has some of the hockey sense to also know where to find them and also when to pop out for shots, things of that nature, I think that's a useful player to have on a line. Does he have the skill, sort of the speed, the explosiveness to really elevate that line? No, but he's kind of just like a stabilizing presence on whatever line he plays with this season.
And I think probably your point about his work along the wall there, that really also applies to the defensive zone. I think that he helps with the breakout significantly.
Yes.
And as a result of that, when you look at some of the underlying numbers, like the Rapham charts, you see that he's really, really good defensively. Like, that is his big strength for the Ducks this season, is defensive work. And the thing is, when you need to contextualize kind of what we're talking about defensively, we're not talking about playing physical. We're not talking about what the general thought is when you think of defensive hockey. It's not boxing out. It's not hitting guys. It's about winning the puck back and creating things to get out of your zone. It's suppressing shots against. It's being on the ice for less expected goals against, and really limiting the damage that happens against. And for a Ducks team that has that happening a lot, getting pinned in their zone, to have a guy this high defensively from these metrics is showing you the work that he's able to do on the wall. And that, I think people get so focused on maybe some of the missed chances in the offensive zone.
Yes.
Maybe, I mean, his foot speed is not there anymore, and that's such an easy thing to see. But you kind of miss these little plays that he's able to make along the walls to help get the puck out of the zone or win the puck back to get it out of the zone and suppress chances against.
And occasionally he'll have a little speed burst. He'll drive to
the
net.
But I mean, what we're seeing from him when you look at these numbers is quality of shots for, expected goals for, he's about average, like zero from a Z-score perspective. From a quantity perspective, he's above average, but defensively he's well above average, both from a quality and quantity perspective. Mm-hmm. And these are individualized metrics that try to isolate the player for what they're doing. You can't fully isolate systems and things like that, but this is trying to isolate his play versus the other guys on the ice.
Well, I do feel like just when I watch if I'm watching the line that he's on in that game, I feel like he's not in his own zone that often. I feel like he's one of the few guys that is actually able to get it out.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, just for some added context on Killorn, like, he's 35. He is firmly past his prime. It's very rare for NHL players to still be where they were when they get into their mid-30s. And so the fact that he's still adding value, like, in my opinion, And I think that it's not even really an opinion because, like you said, there's stats to back it up.
To still get the highest goals above replacement on the team.
Yeah, to still be a positive player, even if, yes, the production is not there. He's also not playing with Nikita Kucherov anymore, might I add. But to still be a positive player at 35 is pretty good. I mean, it's he for a 35-year-old, he looks pretty good out there to me. So shout out to Alex Killorn. Am I sitting here telling you all he's this amazing player and you should just, you know, stop criticizing him and say he's amazing? No, I think that it's fair to be critical, especially because of the contract, but we're just providing the other side of that and why we are not as down on him as other people are. So,
yep.
But yes, I do really want to talk about this McTavish on the wing thing because was Tampa Bay the first game where they did that?
Because they were shut out against Washington.
It's so funny you bring up that Mitch Brown quote because that was a couple of years ago now, and it feels like, once again, Mitch Brown just knew all along what took the Ducks years to get to. But one thing that had really been sticking out, there's a couple things. I think that there's multiple things at play that go into this new line of McTavish on the wing next to Carlson and Killorn. One is that I think they are trying to get Leo Carlson going. I think that is a big part of this, is that Leo Carlson, I mean, who was on his wing prior to that? I'm like already forgetting. Was it
Lundestrom?
It was Lundestrom, but wasn't it like Leeson after that? I think that
there
they
was also McGinn.
They've pretty much saddled him with clear cut third line to fourth line talent outside of Alex Killorn, and that has just not really benefited Leo Carlson at all. And so I think that part of it is that they are trying to get him going. The other part of it, and I am really kind of diluting it down to the bare bones here, but Leo Carlson has been bad in the faceoff circle this year. And I think that the Ducks probably internally look at this and say, well, instead of having Leo Carlson winning 38% of his draws, having Mason McTavish there to take the faceoffs but still be a wing, having him taking 50% of those draws or winning 50% of those draws, which is a success rate this season, that'll probably help Leo Carlson anyway. So they may be looking at it that way. I also just think, now zooming it out, like you said earlier, Mason McTavish is really good along the boards. He's really good in puck protection. We saw it with Cutter Gauthier, where when he's playing with a player who's much faster than him, he is really good at just getting them the puck, finding them in space, finding them where they've already built up speed. And that's where Leo Carlson really thrives. And you need guys who can get Leo Carlson the puck. I've said that multiple times this season, but Mason McTavish can do that. And we saw that multiple times already in the two games they've played. You brought up the goal. I mean, McTavish wins a forecheck battle, gets the puck over to Carlson. Carlson snipes it short side. So it just really feels like the theory of these two working together has just played out so beautifully in the two games that they've played. And it's only been two games.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything that you want to add to that?
Nothing to add.
Really?
Because I think you hit the notes exactly perfectly. Nothing to add. I mean, and I kind of also talked about kind of McTavish on the wing already. So not really too much to add from me.
Well, and the other thing too that I thought about, but seeing it actually play out is just the breakout. I mean, again, Leo Carlson is the way that the Ducks break it out is they rim it up the wall to a winger, and the winger has to get the puck to the center who's flying up the middle without the puck. And Leo Carlson is one of the best at doing that, at flying up the middle. Once he gets it, he's going to break down a couple guys and get something going. And if you can't get him the puck, it's problematic. And so Mason McTavish is good at that and is going to help amplify that aspect of his game.
And is able to do that from non-traditional ways, very creative ways to be able to get him the puck. And you had a video you put on Twitter that was showing kind of one of the moves that he was able to make to go between the legs with the puck to get to Leo Carlson and get Leo Carlson out in the rush. And those are the types of deceptive plays also that work a lot better because defenders are really good at the point of reading kind of what you're planning to do, where the puck's going to go. So if you're able to make kind of a unique type of pass like that, a deceptive pass like that, that they may not have been expecting, that opens up more space for the guy that is receiving the puck to enter up the ice and potentially beat the guy around the edge and get up and create a two-on-one rush, because the defender is going to be caught flat-footed a bit by trying to go a different direction. And so that is what you want. You need that creativity there. I think that one of the things that is not talked about enough when it comes from a deception and creativity perspective in general in hockey is that coming off the boards in the defensive zone.
Yes.
Because we talk so much, and so everyone gets so focused on offensive zone to create offense. But you look at how much offense is created off the rush, those are the plays that create that rush. And so when you go back, that is where that all starts. And having that creativity in the defensive zone and not just simply going boards and out, that is where the actual offense is created. And that's kind of also where I come back to talking about this team overall, right? And we get, and the Ducks and Greg Cronin get so focused on shots on goal and passing up shots on goal when they should be talking about plays off the board in the defensive zone to create rushes going the other way. Mm-hmm. The issue is that that's not the type of offense that they want to create. They want to go board and out, get the puck back in the neutral zone, have, and essentially you are attacking guys that are back. So that's when you have to chip it in, get in and get pucks back, and everyone's all covered. You're essentially trying to make it into a situation where everyone's going to be covered, move the puck high, and then create havoc by just throwing it on net, when that's just really not shown to be a very repeatable way for success.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that to take it back to that play you mentioned, it's on my Twitter if people want to see it, but just the fact that McTavish gets that puck, and he's actually facing the other way from Leo Carlson. Mm-hmm. So before he ever received the puck, he had to have quickly glanced and made a mental map of what was going on the ice and know that Carlson is going to be coming up behind him, because he gets the puck and then one touches it through his legs without looking behind the back. So Carlson is behind him and he one touches it to him over, and then Carlson gets it and he's pressured and he's able to just hook the puck into space, and McTavish is already there because McTavish is anticipating that that's what the next play should be. So to see those two hockey minds and their abilities kind of just work in tandem like that, I mean, that's the path for this team right now. Because as we've talked about ad nauseum, Greg Cronin's tactics are not the path right now to this team being interesting or exciting. I mean,
his tactics aren't the path. And it feels like we've kind of talked a lot of positivity right now. And not to say that there aren't positives to be taken away, but I also think that there are still a lot of frustrations, I think, that can be had with how he is managing this team overall.
I just wanted to just kind of round out the thought is that the path right now is just to get the combinations right, because despite the system, despite the coach, despite everything, these guys are really talented and really smart. And so if you just put them together, good things are going to happen. I know it's this wild thought, but that's the path right now.
And that's the same reason why there was so much frustration about what they were doing with the defense, right?
Yeah, that, we should probably talk about the defense.
Yeah, I was about to get there. And I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I think it's definitely worth mentioning. We had some comments from Brent Thompson. I think it was it before the Tampa game or the Panthers game?
I think it was Tampa. Yeah.
Talking about the defense. And do you remember them off the top of your head? Because I actually don't fully.
He just talked about how, you know, each guy is growing. And I think that the big one that kind of stuck out was that it's such a luxury to be able to take any one of them out and not have any drop off in play. And it's like, well, there is a drop off when Olin Zellweger isn't in the lineup.
This was not a banner week for Brent Thompson for me. With that quote that came out, and then
the penalty kill.
The Tampa game specifically, where the penalty kill, which is what he manages, was extremely poor.
Yes.
And it's been extremely poor all season. It's the worst penalty kill in the league from an expected goals perspective against. Don't really know where it's at from an actual percentages, because I don't usually look at success rate and things like that. I more so want to look at kind of the chances that they're giving up. But, I mean, I think Washington played well against them on the penalty kill. Same thing, Carolina scored two goals and one penalty. With that coming back and on set plays that were the exact same. And then you had, Tampa just absolutely torched them. I don't think I've ever seen a power play get the puck to the dangerous area as easily as Tampa was able to do.
That was nuts. That was embarrassing.
And, And then the Panthers, I think the Ducks had a better penalty kill situation against the Panthers, but still not exactly a banner week with that.
I mean, not a banner week for special teams. I mean,
correct.
Did you talk about the Ducks power play giving up four breakaways
against Tampa? Nope. And then had a 5-minute major where they look lifeless against the Panthers.
Yeah, I watched that today and not great. Not great. It feels like Rich Kloon has kind of got to go back to the drawing board a little bit.
Yeah, but getting back to the original point here was talking about the defense. And the good news, I think, to come out of this little stretch was, I guess, Washington was a frustration point because Drew Helison drew back in after Olin Zellweger had come into the lineup against the Panthers. Then he came out for Drew Helison, and then they lost, got shut out, allowed, what, 5 goals, was it, against Washington? Is that right?
No, they lost 3-0.
3-0, sorry. All the games are blending.
How dare you?
At this point. But Olin Zellweger came back in. They had Zellweger and Minchkov in the lineup, as they should be, against the Lightning and against the Panthers. But they're still just not playing as much as they should. One of those guys always is not playing as much. Cutter Gauthier is playing 11 minutes a night. We're still seeing Brian Dumoulin and Jacob Trouba paired together in late games tied situations. It's not as if, even through all of this, right? And we've talked about how frustrating it is having those guys out, and talked about ad nauseum the quote from before the season from Elliot Friedman, where he was talking about the reason why the Ducks were looking to move Cam Fowler was they knew the quality left-hand defenseman that they had, and they wanted to get them in these games late. And yet, against Tampa Bay, when they're tied late in a game, Brian Dumoulin and Jacob Trouba are the ones on the ice together when they're not a pairing, instead of one of Olin Zellweger or Pavel Minchikov. And this is something that we've seen multiple times, and we saw it against Carolina. They got scored on, and I didn't really look at the Panthers game too much just because of them being shut out, so I think they probably were divvied up a bit more. But we've seen so many different times. Oh, what the hell, I'm looking at the game and I must have zoned this out. Jacob Trouba was on the ice in the 6-on-5 late in the game. There's that. There's that for you.
Well, isn't it funny how Greg Cronin was saying in that last Florida game how, oh, well, you know, it's just they're the defending champs. They're going to shut us down at the end there as we're trying to come back. It's like I watched those last 5 minutes, and the Ducks look like a team that just didn't realize they were down 2-0 and wasn't doing anything to actually score.
And that's something we haven't talked about too much. I guess if you want to have any sort of positivity from this road trip, I think against Tampa at 5-on-5, they looked better, especially late in the game. Sure. The issue is they were so bad at special teams that made any sort of 5-on-5 play really kind of get thrown out the window. Against Florida, through 2 periods, they were better. But I think the major negative from that is that you're going into a 3rd period against the defending champs down by 1. You've kind of played a really solid enough game against them. You've played at least a tight enough game against them to be in it. And you have 0 effort. And to me, that is fully on coaching. We'll go to the coaching well so many times, but that in so many ways is on coaching. That's on you to get your players out there, be prepared, play a strong and hard 3rd period to try to win that game, tie the game and win the game. And it felt like they were already on the airplane for that 3rd period.
Yeah, that 3rd period was abysmal against Florida. And also, I mean, the goal that Gibson gave up, the 2nd goal.
True.
I mean, that wasn't great. I mean, that shot was going wide, and it hits Gibson's blocker, and it goes back in. So maybe goaltending wasn't on their side, but offensively they were just so dormant, and especially at the end of the game where they're trying to come back, they just have nothing in the tank. It was pretty disappointing, but that's kind of what we've come to expect. But I do think that it is positive that Zellweger is at least getting back into the lineup. I also think that Minchikov is playing a lot better recently. Yes. I actually think he looks as good as he's looked all season as of late. He's so much more involved offensively. He's getting those chances. I don't know if this happens to you, but he gets those chances where he ends up at the front of the net somehow. And then I have to go back and look wait, how did he end up there? How did a defenseman end up at the doorstep of the other team's net? And so those two have looked better. I think it's good that Drew Helison is kind of sitting for a little bit because he's looked really shaky. Yeah. But the defense remains problematic.
I mean, here's the thing with this team is that...
Tell me what the thing is.
The success needs to be driven by these young players.
Yes.
That is the reality of this team. and doing anything else does not help this team. I mean, first off, it's not helping this team in the short term. This team defensively is not good. This team at 5-on-5 is not good. This is the 31st team in the league. And maybe now it's time for a bit of a global conversation about the team and where they're at now, unless you have another talking point that you want to get to. But like at this point, these guys need to be put in a spot to drive the offense, drive the team, move things out. And it's like there's just a hesitancy to do that. Like there's still just an over-reliance on, I mean, from the offensive perspective also, this over-reliance on Vetrano, Strome, Terry. Like they're playing 22 minutes a night.
Yeah, I think that right now, if we can isolate one thing that I think really needs to change in terms of handing the keys over to the kids, because that hasn't fully happened this season. Like you just said, Strome line has been the top line. Trouba and Dumoulin are still kind of like the crutch pairing for Cronin in late game situations or late period situations. He puts them out there. Here's the thing, and we're going to have plenty of time to talk about this, so I don't want to get too much into it right now. But doesn't it feel like a Brian Dumoulin trade helps this a lot? Because if you trade Brian Dumoulin, now you've created a spot for Drew Helison, and you're kind of done here. Like, now it's four kids to two olds. So it's almost impossible not to give them some of the tougher assignments. And some might say, oh, they're not ready for it, blah, blah. But, like, at some point, this is what you need to do. You got to turn it over. And they started off the season doing that, and then they shied away from it.
And
but shying away from it has not made the team any better. They've been worse, arguably.
Yeah, I think that's the point, is that some people say they're not ready for it. It's like, what else could be happening right now that would make you think that, like, that they're not ready? Like, this team is not playing well with them not doing that. And their best stretch defensively came with those four young players in the lineup.
And also, I mean, you pointed it out, but I think prior to getting back into the lineup this week, Zellweger hadn't, he played like three of the last 12 games or something like that.
I think three it was of the like last four, 10. Three of the last 10, four of the last 11.
Like, that just can't be helping his development to be barely playing. Now he's played a bit, so he's back. What do you think is going to happen with Brian Dumoulin? Because his cap hit is not small. He's at 3.15, pending UFA, 33 years old, hasn't had a great season. What's the summary here? I mean, what's the value? What are they going to do?
I don't actually know. I think they'll retain half. I mean, I think the value is going to end up being like a second or third round pick.
Yeah, it's funny because I've seen discussions even in our own Discord of people saying, oh, well, they can get a second for Dumoulin, and then there's pushback on that. And I mean, think about the market for defensemen at the trade deadline. Like, Brian Dumoulin is a Stanley Cup champion,
yep,
top four defenseman, veteran, been there, minute muncher. Like, if you retain salary, I feel like you're getting a second. I think that maybe his value in the abstract is a third, but I think that if you retain, it bumps it up to a second.
I mean, the Ducks received a third-round pick for Lyubushkin last year.
Yeah. I mean, there you go. I mean, that's really it. Dumoulin is better than Lyubushkin.
Yeah. So, granted, left-handed versus right-handed, but still.
True. True. But Lyubushkin's not good.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Miguel's asking how many contracts can they retain money on. I don't think there's any money retention on the books right now, so they can do three.
Fowler.
Correct. Sorry. You're right. So, two.
Two, yes. But that's the thing. They can trade Dumoulin and retain. I think that's the one that they are going to have to retain on. I mean, if they want to trade Robbie Fabry, who's also a pending UFA, he's at $4 million. So they could also retain for him if they wanted to. And that's pretty much it. I mean, there's no one else that you're really going to trade on. I guess the only thing that you'd have to be worried about is, and this is controversial, but if the Ducks eventually trade John Gibson this season, I have a hard time imagining they trade him without any retention. So maybe you want to keep that spot open, and maybe that's why some of these other deals don't happen. I don't know. Do you think Gibson gets traded? As you saw in my spar this week with Frank Saravalli. Did we talk about that on the last pod?
I think we did.
Because we recorded this Monday. Yeah. So we're still in the same week.
No, we're not. Sunday's a new week.
We're in the same week.
Sunday is a new week.
No. On the calendar, it is Monday through Sunday. your Google calendar. Monday through Sunday is part of the same week. A week is 7 days.
Sunday to Saturday is the week.
It's not.
Okay, everyone out there, please chime in on this in the chats. Are weeks Sunday to Saturday or Monday to Sunday?
Is the week Monday to... I'm Googling this.
The week starts on Sunday.
I will eat crow if I'm wrong about this.
Think about how a calendar is shaped. When you open up a calendar, the first day of a week is
square.
A Sunday.
It's square. What does that answer? Monday is the first day of the week. That's what Reddit says.
No, when you click on your calendar.
Reddit has never been wrong.
Look at your calendar.
I'm closing the books.
When you look at the lines, Sunday is the first day that's listed. That is the first column.
Reddit told me Monday, so I'm done here. Sorry.
Sunday.
If you can provide a credible source that says that, I will believe you.
I guarantee it's Sunday to Saturday.
Your word, I'm sorry, is not sufficient.
Wow.
Hey, I'm telling you, I am willing to believe you.
Just
so you know, my own calendar, my own Google calendar is Sunday through Saturday. Does that make me crazy?
You said Sunday to Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's how I have it look. That doesn't mean that's how I think a week
that
actually
is. That is how almost every single person
Monday
in the world,
is the first day of the week. Do you agree with that?
Monday is the first day of the work week.
Do you agree that Monday is the first day of the week?
No, Sunday is.
So when we say on the seventh day he rested, what do we mean by that? I've got you in a corner. You're sipping wine. You are done.
We mean Saturday.
Dude, you are done. I just went biblical on you. Okay.
The Bible defines our calendars.
Last
I checked, all my Jewish holidays are not based
upon
our calendar.
This is in the Old Testament, so we're overlapping.
Correct. But Jewish holidays follow lunar calendar, which is different.
Good on me for building a relationship between Christianity and
Sunday
Judaism.
To Saturday.
Good
Sunday to Saturday. Man, have we just incited a new North and South Oak, South County?
Sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays.
But Blackhawk has a great point that I should have brought up. Jewish tradition, the Sabbath is Saturday. That is the day of rest.
So you're saying we should follow your definition?
I'm saying that this... I'm just saying you said the day of rest, the seventh day, in Judaism, the Sabbath is on Saturday.
Okay. But the seventh day is Sunday.
But the day of rest is Saturday in the Jewish faith.
I guess do you agree that Monday is the first day of the week?
Monday is the first day of the work week.
Sunday
is the first day of the actual week, though.
So on Sunday, you wake up and you think, all right, time to start my week. Is that really what you think on Sunday?
It's the first day of the week, yes. That because of how calendars look.
Your mind is warped by calendars.
Because that is literally how it looks. When you look at like an Outlook calendar.
I don't disagree with you. I just think that Monday is the first day of the week, and I can't believe this is like a controversial take.
Monday is the first day of the work week, yes.
The work week and the week are the same thing.
No, they aren't.
This is capitalism.
Work days are different than regular days.
Our lives are defined by our corporate overlords.
Business days.
Yeah, business is reality.
Connor, our friend Connor is now texting in our group chat saying I'm wrong. No, I'm not. I'm not wrong. It's Sunday to Saturday.
Like, I understand where you're coming from, and I'm not here to belittle you. I'm not. But I think you're completely wrong. So
Brandon Pineda with the great point. Time is a construct. There's no right answer.
Well, yeah, Monday through Sunday is made up anyway. Like the days themselves are made up.
And Hammock also says this is what happens when engineers argue with lawyers.
I mean, I'm right, you're wrong. Is that the clue? Anyway,
man,
what we were talking about.
I don't either. But back to what we were saying. Oh, we were talking about last podcast and the Gibson part of it.
Yeah, it's the same week. We're in the same week.
No, we are not. Different
anyway,
week. Regardless.
Anyway, you want to keep a retention slot open for Gibson.
Yeah, you do.
I also just think, what are you getting for Robbie Fabry?
Nothing. Like, no.
Like a fourth? Like, yeah. It just doesn't matter. I mean, I just think the benefit of trading him is just not have him on your team. But
No, but one thing I want to say kind of about this team overall, just as a general concept for it, which we talked about a little bit last week, saying this, like, something has to change, there needs to be better. Just the more that this goes on, the more I really settle in on, like, this team should be better than this.
Yes.
Like, the talent on this team, and there was a little bit of pushback saying, what if the talent's just not as good as we all think it is? And, well, yes, like, maybe that's the case. I'm not stating this team should be a playoff contender, this should be a playoff team. This team should just be better than what they're showing from an on-ice perspective. They should not be the 31st team in the league from an expected goals perspective. They should not be struggling in the way they are. They have more talent on this roster to be a better team than that. And you look at your team, the Montreal Canadiens.
I was going to bring them up.
You look at the Columbus Blue Jackets. Like, you look at what these teams are doing that are probably in a similar vein to the Ducks from a talent perspective. And it just goes to show what having a coach that really puts these guys in opportunities to thrive can do. And this is just even ignoring wins and losses and just looking at play. Like, this Ducks from a 5-game rolling sample size or at rolling average perspective, I think have barely been above 50% once. They've been under 50% the entire season. There's been no blips of them
There hasn't been a glimpse of hope.
No, like, the glimpse of hope was probably that little stretch where they were running the four young defensemen out there. But even then, like, it still wasn't fantastic. And it really just hyper-focuses for me on how poor the coaching staff has been for this team this season. And just, they're not putting these guys in positions to thrive.
Well, yeah, I was thinking, like, the best stretch was probably when Zegras was playing with Killorn and Gauthier. Like, that was probably that was probably when there was the most hope.
And then they took him away.
But you look at the top three, like, you look at the two wildcard teams in the East right now, Ottawa and Columbus. I think that I'll comfortably say that the Ottawa Senators roster is better than the Ducks. But the Ottawa Senators roster is in a similar time frame to the Ducks. Like, yes, Tim Stützle is clearly a franchise player and all of that, and yes, they have a lot of good young players, but so do the Ducks. I don't think that the Ducks are quite at that level, and they're not I'm not bringing them up to say that the Ducks should be the first wild card team in the West, but I think that they should be more competitive than what they've shown in the standings. Then you look at the Columbus Blue Jackets. Argument gets even worse for Greg Cronin, because the Blue Jackets roster, to me, is it better than the Ducks roster? It might be a little better. I'm not even sure.
I don't think so. Maybe Werenski, you could say, is probably the best out of all the players.
I mean,
on the two
Marchenko,
teams.
Voronkov are studs. The thing is, they're being put in positions to succeed, right? And Sean Monahan has been really good for them. But I look at that roster, I'm like, yeah, that's about on par with the Ducks. It's not that much better. And yet they're a solid 5-on-5 team. They are the second wild card seed in the East. And then this is the one that just destroys. This just really is damaging for the case of, oh, well, we don't know about this roster and Greg Cronin this, Greg Cronin that. The Montreal Canadiens are 1 point out of the playoffs right now. And this I can say for sure. You look at the Montreal Canadiens roster, and I personally am a fan of a lot of the players that are on it because I'm a fan of the team, so I'm a little biased. But that roster and the Ducks roster, is there a huge gap between the two? Like, you could say maybe that the Canadiens' top six has better high-end talent. Suzuki's further along. Caulfield's a little further along. But then Slavkovsky's still really young. Kirby Dach is coming off an injury. Patrick Laine is coming off an injury. They don't have that much more talent than the Ducks, and yet they are playing sound 5-on-5 hockey since about the month of December. They are now knocking at the door of the playoffs. They are in the mix. They are playing meaningful games. So you look at the totality of these teams, Ottawa, Columbus, Montreal, and you look at those rosters and you look at where they are, and I think to myself, maybe the Ducks shouldn't be right where those teams are, but they should be much, much closer to those teams.
They should be in that mix.
They should be in that mix that those teams are in, and as in, they should be at least playing competitive, meaningful games, not necessarily in a playoff spot. Maybe that's me overrating the roster, but again, I challenge people. Look at these teams, player for player, on paper. I think the Ducks have an argument to be in that conversation. So, yeah. That's what gets me fired up about this whole season. I mean, you know, Utah is, it's interesting because Utah is a team that's playing a lot better than the Ducks at 5-on-5, but they, you know, points wise, they're also a bit out of it, 6 points out. So it's just frustrating. And I think that that's another point that people have brought up is that I feel like we're also just not really finding anything out about these players at this point because they're so shackled to this system and to this way of playing that we're not really able to find out, are they true offensive drivers? Like, we need to know these things. The Ducks need to know these things so that they can then make decisions, right? Yep. Just the whole thing is just very broken. We're an hour in.
Yeah, we should get to questions.
Yeah, I just hit me. Yes, let's do that.
All right, so we're going to start with our Discord. Go to patreon.com/crashspawned where you can subscribe to our Patreon at the $2 tier. You get access to the Discord, and you can get into our channel and ask questions in there for the show. D-Frenzy asked this question. I really believe Aikens caused Zegras to not win the Calder. Putting him with third, fourth liners and Delorier most nights really hurt how offensively productive he could be. I know that this rookie class is stacked, but did Greg Cronin hurt Cutter in a similar manner? Sidebar, Lane Hutson for Calder, and I will be taking no questions.
That is a great take. Lane Hutson is the favorite for a rookie of the year. You know Lane Hudson's on pace for 60-plus assists?
It's insane. But Do you think Greg Cronin hurt Cutter in a similar manner?
It's actually a fascinating question because as much as I've poo-pooed Greg Cronin this season, to put it lightly, there was that interesting article by Elite Prospects by David St. Louis, friend of the pod, writing about Cutter Gauthier and talking about what we've been talking about, which is that the details and the engagement in his game has been so good this season that he's really brought this added dimension to his game that he didn't really show enough of in college. And I think, does Greg Cronin deserve some credit for getting that out of him? Yep. Or was that something that was always going to happen when he hit the NHL?
I think he deserves credit. Like, I think if we're going to be critical of Cronin, like, and I've mentioned this a bunch, if we're going to be critical of him for all of these other things, we have to be fair and balanced in this as much as we can. And give him credit when it is actually due. And fair I think and balanced. when you look at Cutter Gauthier and the development within his game from an overall perspective, I think that Greg Cronin does deserve credit for that. I think you could also be critical of the line mates that he's been given in terms of limiting his production, but the overall play that Cutter Gauthier has been playing, I think, is good overall. It has not led to the points as of yet for various different reasons, but I also don't know if that, I don't know if that limited Gauthier's ability to win the Calder, because I don't think he would be able to match what Hudson's doing or what Celebrini's doing.
Yeah, so, I just don't think Cutter Gauthier was coming into the NHL this season and putting up 60 points.
Yeah.
We didn't anticipate that. And yeah, I think to a degree, Cronin has held them back a bit offensively with the line mates, like you mentioned, but I do think we should give Cronin a little credit, I guess, for the fact that Gauthier has become a very solid two-way player. And again, it's one of those things, chicken or the egg, but we'll give him the credit. So,
yep. D Frenzy also asked, looking at Kaapo Kakko's success in Seattle, should the Ducks have been in on him? What would have been a good trade for both sides if so?
Well, didn't Seattle trade like Will Borgen?
Will Borgen, and wasn't it like a second round pick?
I don't even think it was a second. I could be wrong about that.
Kaapo Kakko trade. Let's see what the trade was at. Borgen and two picks, a third and a sixth.
Yeah, not even a second. I think that the issue was that it sounds like the Rangers really wanted Will Borgen. I mean, anyway, not to get into the whole nuts and bolts of that. Yes, the Ducks should have been in on him. They should have been in on Kakko because it just makes sense. Take a flyer on a young player. Why not? A good trade for both sides. I mean, this is, I guess, the issue is I don't know what the equivalent would have been of a Will Borgen for the Ducks.
Dumoulin, maybe?
I mean, Dumoulin's probably the one, but he doesn't really fit because I think
he's also not right.
Borgen's still under contract, I think, beyond this season.
No, he's not.
Oh. Wait. Really?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
There's talks about the Rangers flipping him.
Hold on. I don't believe you.
Will Borgen.
I want to believe you, but I. Oh my God.
Yeah, right? He's UFA. Yeah.
So the Rangers flipped the former second overall pick for a rental UFA, a third and sixth.
Yeah.
That is abysmal. That is actually really, really bad.
That's why Brian Dumoulin would be the closest. The only thing is he's not right-handed.
Yeah. Yeah, and Kako has, like, he's got a bunch of points since he joined the Kraken.
Almost, I think he's almost a point per game.
Yep. So, yeah, the Ducks should have been in on that, but I kind of throw my hands up at that just because Will Borgen, if you want Will Borgen, like, there's nothing I can do to stop you.
Yeah. Yep. Sean 11 said, how poorly does it reflect on Verbeek that he is possibly not willing to fire Cronin in the middle of the season because he thinks that it will look bad on him? I would at least suspect it if he owned the mistake and ripped the Band-Aid off as soon as possible. Should it cause us to doubt his ability to be the GM of the team? Can I add something on this real quick?
Sure.
So I'm going to hold any sort of judgment until the Four Nation face off.
Well, we also just don't know what he's thinking.
Correct. Correct. But I also think if there is a time, if Greg Cronin is going to be fired midseason, we're what, 2 weeks away from that?
Are we? Shit.
I think. Right?
I don't know. You and I and dates and calendars tonight, it's just not.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like 2 weeks away. So uh-huh. I think giving Cronin until that point makes sense, and then you make your decision then if you're going to fire him.
It is more like 3 weeks away.
Still.
4 weeks away, actually. Okay. Maybe a bit further.
Well,
I don't know when the actual break is. Because it starts on the 12th, so I don't know exactly when the break starts.
When the last game is. Yeah. But, yeah, I think it's
that seems like a situation. That seems like a while.
It does, but I think that's the logical point of getting to a spot of, okay, they've been playing this bad. Yes, they had that winning streak, but we are now far enough removed. Like, I think that winning streak bought him some leeway here and some runway. And so if they make it to that point and he's still here, I think that Pat Verbeek should have some sort of statement that comes out.
Let me just ask you something just fully off the cuff here.
Okay.
Do you think Greg Cronin gets fired this season?
I'm 50-50.
I actually don't think he will. Just because I just feel like it would just be really surprising for some reason.
It would be, but I'm... The reason why I'm 50-50 is, yes, I think it would still be surprising because I think of everything Verbeek said over summer. But at the end of the day, if this Ducks team still, and if this 18-wheeler still continues to go off the rails, to steal a term from the Toronto Maple Leaf.
What a visual.
But if it continues to go off the rails and they continue to lose games and back their way into that break, like, this is a year where Pat Verbeek came out and said last year he did not want to be a seller at the deadline. He wanted this team to be playing meaningful games come March, maybe pump the brakes on making the playoffs, but be in that mix and be in that race and play those games for the young players. And so I think to not be in that mix, to be playing so poorly, I think all of that would be an abject failure. And I think if Pat Verbeek views the team as having a chance to still get there, if they are maybe in, like, everyone else is faltering also, and they're maybe 8 points out, 9 points out, something like that, maybe he makes the change thinking of that. And, or maybe if they're further out, he wants to rip the Band-Aid off, as Sean 11 brings up, and get his a new coach in here to end the season strong and get everything set up so he can have a full off season with these guys as compared to a partial off season.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is that if the team is just so clearly out of it, even now, what doesn't that almost feel like it lowers the chance that they fire him? Because it's like, well, now what's the point? This new coach is not going to come in and turn things around.
No, but he at least gets a stretch with the team, and I think and I think specifically can get the team feeling better going into the end of the season. And I think get better the morale matters. Up. Like, you look at what the Canadians did. Because didn't Martin St-Louis come in at the end of the season?
Yes, he came in about mid-season, I want to say. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, they had that magical run when he first got there.
And to Sean 11's other question, should it cause us to doubt his ability to be the GM of this team if he does not fire him? I don't think as of yet, but I think if, for me, the big thing is Cronin back next year. If he is, then that starts to raise alarm bells for me.
But here's my issue with your take.
Okay.
Is that If we all agree that Greg Cronin is this net negative for the team, and the team continues to play like trash, and the team continues to lose, get shut out, not be competitive, what is Pat Verbeek doing not making a change? Like, what, like, at a certain point, you can't really rationalize keeping the coach around.
For the, as in,
even this season, even this season, if in 3 weeks from now they've lost even more games, they're at the clip that they're on right now, how do you justify?
Oh, I agree. That's why he needs to answer questions about it.
But what I'm saying is that if we get to that point, they continue to lose, they continue on their stretch, and he doesn't fire him, to the question, I think it should cause some doubt about Pat Verbeek. Like, is he blind? Like, what is the strategy here?
Fair. I think that's, for me, maybe I have a little bit more leeway because I could see what you're saying about what's the benefit of firing him mid-season. I disagree, and I think that there is an actual benefit to doing that, to have the players playing well. But I think for me, when I really start to question it and cause at least me to doubt personally Pat Verbeek's ability to be the GM of this team, that would come if Greg Cronin is back next year.
Well, that would be a death knell. That would be correct. Absolutely. But I mean, the other thing too is, like, what is the argument for keeping Greg Cronin? Because
the argument is he thought they played well in the four or five winning streak.
I just think that if Pat Verbeek continues this narrative of Greg Cronin is our guy and we believe in him and blah blah, after, like, at the break of the Four Nations, I do question his judgment.
If he comes out and says that, then yes, I would,
like,
agree.
I severely question his judgment if he is still banging the Greg Cronin drum. We can't both be super critical of the coach and the performances and then be okay with him staying around and being endorsed.
I think if he's being endorsed, you're 100% correct. Yeah. I think if he answers it and says, I'm not happy, like, if there's an answer that's kind of a half answer but not a full endorsement, then it's a different conversation.
Also, how much does the win-loss, do you think, factor into all of this? Like, for Pat Verbeek's view of the team?
High.
Because they're, what are they, like, 18 and 22, 18 and 21, something like that?
Something like that. You know what's funny? I was looking at their actual wins and losses before we went live.
Mm-hmm.
The team is better from a points perspective through 46 games than they were last year. 42 mm-hmm. points versus 31 points. Here's really? The difference.
Yeah. 42 versus 31?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
But they're not better, though.
Here's the difference. Two regulation wins. They have won two more games in regulation. The main difference is this year they have 6 overtime losses. Last year they had 1. Or yeah. Overtime and shootout losses. The main thing is they're just winning the games that are going to overtime / more games are going to overtime.
And goaltending.
Yes, that too. But, I mean, their negative 34 goal differential last year was a negative 44 goal differential.
Do you really think Pat Verbeek looks at this and says, we have 11 more points than we did last year, we're 18 and 22? And
I sure as hell hope not.
Like, that would be the most ass-backwards way of looking at this whole situation. Yeah. Like that would act, like, if he says anything like that in a comment, I will criticize that loudly, because I just think if you're getting paid millions of dollars to be the GM of an NHL team, your analysis needs to be more refined than, oh, well, look at our points. It just has to be. Yep. It has to be more refined than that.
Yep. All right, let's get to more questions because we're at an hour 15 right now. Brad said, 2 years from now, assuming no trade or FA pickups, this is a long question. Brad, I'm going to ask you, Patreon. Save this for a Patreon question.
We'll answer. Well, let's try to do one. 2 years from now, I mean, Minchikov and Zellweger are still around. Lacombe is still around. I mean, that's 3 of 6.
Yeah.
So Helleson is still around.
Let's go with
Luneau. I mean, we're at 5 out of 6 right there.
Okay, 2 years from now, and Jacob Trouba is probably still a Duck 2 years from now.
So Trouba is on your third pairing.
Probably. Let's go.
Trouba, Zellweger.
Trouba, Zellweger, Minchikov, Helleson, Lacombe, Luneau.
Oof, that Lacombe Luno pairing is an adventure, but
it's almost like you want Luno with Trouba, but
Luno Zellweger?
Maybe.
I think I like that a little better.
And then Minchikov, Trouba,
Minchikov Helleson.
And then Lacombe Trouba.
Trouba's going to be on this team. Like, we just got to live with it. I mean, it won't be a huge difference for Lacombe. He's playing with Gudas right now.
That's fair point. Fair point. All right. Ducks Dragonaut says, as we approach the trade deadline in what is yet another lost season, what can Pat Verbeek target as some late season changes with coaching or roster to make you feel like he's starting to right the ship and get the ball rolling positively in the offseason? New coach.
Well, I think that the roster question is, that ship has kind of sailed because Pat Verbeek sought out Jacob Trouba. So that kind of tells us everything. But I also don't think the roster really needs that much tweaking. I think
correct.
The roster just needs to be optimized.
I want to see this roster with an NHL quality coach.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and also I think Ducks Jaggernaut's framing as a lost season is becoming correct. Like, what is being accomplished this season? It's very difficult to see. So,
yep. All right. We got a couple questions from Twitter. So, let's see. Trevor Zebra said, two questions for you guys tonight. Do you guys think this stretch of boring hockey and lack of goal scoring is proving to management how valuable Trevor Zegras really is?
Definitely on the power play.
Yeah. And do you think Brock Besser is a guy that Verbeek will go after this summer? And if so, what contract would you guys feel comfortable with giving him?
Oh, God.
I don't see there being space.
Like, just on the team?
I guess I don't see Besser as being the guy you go after in terms of what this team needs from a long-term perspective, and I don't view there as being space for him long-term on the roster
either. I mean, I think as far as forwards are concerned, for me, it's either you go for a superstar forward or you go for a depth forward. Like, I think the Brock Bessers are actually the guys you avoid on the open market. So.
Correct. Yep.
He's agreed. Only 27. Dang, I thought he was older than that.
Random Hockey Thoughts on Blue Sky said, given the Ducks rebuild is over, how do you evaluate it? Does anyone except Carlson have a chance to become an elite player? And then also, won't we end up like LA? Good enough to make the first round a few times, but not more. I mean, does anyone have a chance except Carlson to become an elite player? I mean, I think Zegras, I think Carlson, I think Minchikov, I think Zellweger, I think Seneca has a chance.
Hold on. You're saying everyone has a chance to be an elite player?
Elite, I mean, yes.
How do we define elite player?
I guess Zegras maybe not elite. Carlson, Minchikov, Zellweger.
Of the forwards, it's really just Carlson.
Probably.
Like, if we're, I mean, I'm drawing a hard line at what elite is and holding it up higher.
Maybe Seneca. Maybe.
I think Seneca has probably just more potential at this point.
Yeah.
So I would consider including him, but you don't need like five elite forwards. Most teams have maybe two to three. So at most,
yeah. So. And LA, like, I actually dislike that framing. Like, LA has been a good team. They've just been stuck playing the Oilers in the first round for years and years and years.
Well, I would push back on comparing them to the Ducks at all, because the Ducks have way more young pieces.
Correct.
And they have way more. And even though I kind of drew a line on elite, the Ducks have way more guys up front who can develop into top six pieces. Well,
I don't think he's getting at it from comparing the two rosters. I think he's comparing it from how the outcomes have been for LA.
I think the Ducks' upside is higher.
Sure, but do you think...
But so I'm going to push back on you.
Okay.
I'm going to push back on you because I think while I agree with what you're saying, that yes, LA is not... Like, they're overhated, to use our...
Correct.
Discordism, which is not a real word, by the way. But I think that even if, let's say, LA gets past the first round, like, LA is not a team I'm necessarily penciling in as a Stanley Cup favorite.
Fair.
And so I think that what he's getting at is good enough, but not necessarily a team that you...
Fair.
You look at the power ranking as the start of the year, and they're in the top five.
That's a fair point.
I don't think the Ducks are in that category. I think the Ducks can be much better than that. So
that's a fair distinction.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. I guess let's see.
We don't have to do more questions.
Yeah. Actually, sorry. Twitch, YouTube, throw one or two in. We'll get to them. But do you want to do your blind rankings? Do you want to throw me under the bus again?
I mean, you're the one who brought it up. We don't have to do it. Does McDavid get suspended?
Yes.
We're being asked.
Oh, That's something I haven't mentioned. I was curious if Reinhardt was going to have a hearing. It looks like he is not.
Oh.
So Reinhardt will be playing in that game.
Helsen didn't get one either.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the reality is that they're probably looking at it of guys kind of making some pivots late that make it hard. And
was it Reinhardt? I didn't even notice who it was.
Yeah, it was Reinhardt that hit Lundestrom.
I think it was a little worse than Helsen's, to be honest.
It was... They're just different. They're very different to me.
Yes, I agree. It's a different scenario too, because it's a forechecker who's trying to like reach and he's kind of like lunging out.
Yeah.
But his knee was more extended.
His knee was more extended, but I think Helsen had a much higher force behind it, but it was also straight on versus side contact.
So Helsen's defending a rush. It's like,
yeah,
I mean, you're a science guy, physics.
Yeah. So it's just, I think they're both not great. I think they both got major penalties and they both were kind of earlier on. And so they probably deemed that a 5-minute major and missing the rest of the game was probably enough punishment where supplemental discipline was not warranted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Zegras play Tuesday. Unclear.
I hope so.
Logan said, are we overvaluing Woodcroft? By the way, these are from Twitch and YouTube, seeing as we're just trying to go quick here. And then we'll get out of here. Logan said, are we overvaluing Woodcroft because of the lack of their obvious options? I don't think so.
I've kind of reached a point with coaches where it does feel like spinning a wheel a little bit. Like, if a guy's shown something that I'm mildly intrigued by, like Woodcroft with Edmonton, then sure. But that doesn't mean that I'm like wedded to the idea.
So I mean, his Oilers teams were good.
Yeah, they were good. And I think that he brought them to a different level than they were under McClellan beforehand. So,
wait, not, was obviously McClellan not. Oh, yeah, it was. Who was it? What's his face before McClellan?
Dude, the Oilers coaching history.
The Coyotes coach.
Oh, Tippett? History. Let's see.
Was it Tippett before McClellan?
Man, they had so many retreads. Let's see. So, Chris Knobloch. Oh, you were right. Holy shit, I was way wrong. Damn,
I forgot. Was it Tippett between the two?
Dude, you're never going to get this. So, do you want to go in chronological order?
Sure.
So Dallas Aikens, 2013 to 2014-15.
Okay, then was it Todd McClellan?
Then Todd Nelson.
Oh, that's right.
Then Todd McClellan.
Okay.
So now we're still a few coaches. We're still two coaches away from Jay Woodcroft.
Wait, two coaches?
We're two coaches away.
Todd McClellan was fired, and was it an interim head coach that was put in?
I don't know. I don't have that information.
Is it a recognizable name?
It's very recognizable. And I don't have a note that says he was interim. Yeah.
Was it Craig McTavish?
He coached 62 games after Todd McClellan.
Was it Craig McTavish?
No. McTavish was...
No, I. Part of me was wondering, like, if he was like with the Oilers, there was always like old players, part of management, and he went behind the bench for 60 games or something like that. I got nothing in the interest of time.
Ken Hitchcock.
I forgot about Ken Hitchcock being the Oilers head coach.
2018-19, he only coached 62 games, so he must have been interim.
Whoa!
But do you remember when they? I actually remember when they brought him in, and it was like this whole thing.
Same.
Yeah.
I completely forgot about all of that, though.
So then it was Dave Tippett.
Yeah.
And then it was Jay Woodcroft. And then it was... Dude, their coaching history is just hilarious.
Going from Tippett to Woodcroft probably won't be that different than going from Cronin to Woodcroft.
Yeah.
I mean, Tippett's an actual NHL head coach, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, give Dave Tippett some credit here.
I meant more so, like, from a Tippett being a hard-ass perspective.
Philosophy.
Yes.
But we have a couple of questions.
So Connor Davis said, I know it's hard, too early to tell who's each of your FA targets, that you want the Ducks to look at, but kind of wanted to ask that, for me, probably Rantanen, Ehlers, Marner. Those are kind of the group of guys.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yep. Ancient Mariner 84 said, who are the Ducks drafting and in what spot in round one? Quick fire, early guess. I'll say they're drafting fourth overall and I don't know.
You think they drop?
So I will let you pick the player.
Oh, man. This is hard. I think the top three will be Schaefer, Higgins, Misa. So, oh man, I don't know who they're going to pick. I haven't done a deep dive enough. I'll say I don't think they're going to draft Victor Eklund because that would be too fun. I'll say Porter Martone. Seems like a Pat Verbeek guy.
Marc-Andre Mirel, hopefully I didn't screw that name up, said, will the Ducks be better off after trading Dumoulin? Yes.
Yeah, just from the simple fact of making room for the young kids.
Yeah.
Young kids is redundant. Sorry.
Man, it just hit me thinking about that Oilers history. This Ducks history is going to be wild when you think back on it. To go Boudreau, then Carlisle, then Murray, then Akins.
I distinctly remember the day that the Ducks fired Bruce Boudreau. And I remember, I think I remember where I was, which is kind of pathetic, but I remember where I was. And I remember writing an article on the Hockey Writers saying that they were going to like forever regret this. It was like very scathing. And
take your victory lap, King.
That take has aged pretty well.
Take your victory lap.
Because it has been nothing but awful since.
I mean, they did make a conference final there, but that was largely a Bruce Boudreau team still.
And that conference final never felt like, oh, this is like part of something that's going to continue.
Correct.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Has anyone worn number 18 since Patrick Eves?
I don't know.
I feel like someone must have.
Let's see. Jersey. I mean, there's a very easy way.
Yeah, Hockey Reference.
Hockey Reference has the ability to look it up. Yeah, Robert Hagg.
Oh my God, that's right. I knew it would be someone like stupid and random. And sorry Robert to Hagg, Robert dude. Hagg is stupid and random. But... Wow.
Shots fired.
Oh, man. Yeah, I was like, did they like soft retire Patrick Eves' number?
Nope. They did not.
Anyway. Okay. We should probably do this blind ranking and then get out of here.
Yep.
Okay. So blind rank NBA players from the 2000s. So you have to rank these 1 through 5 and you don't know what comes next. This is a fun game because Jake has a lot of random knowledge about the NBA players from the 2000s. And we like to see him struggle with it. So up first, Ray Allen. Where are you ranking Ray Allen? Number three. You've learned from last week. Safe play. Love Ray Allen, though. Up next, Dirk Nowitzki. Ooh,
do I go 2 or 1?
Dirk Nowitzki is very underrated all time, in my opinion.
I know. Do I do 2 or 1?
I think 2 is safer.
I think 2 is much safer.
You don't want Kobe Bryant at 5 again.
I don't want Kobe Bryant at 5 again.
Is Dirk above Kobe? Oh, I'll table that. Dirk at 2. Okay. Kyrie Irving. You got to say something about the player, though. Like, I'm letting you off the hook. You got to say something about the player that you know. Any factoid?
Kyrie Irving played at Duke.
Wow, you got the college. I think he played like 6 games or something at Duke, but...
I think he played a full season.
No, I don't think so.
I thought he played a full season.
I'm not going to look this up, but...
Ray Allen don't know where he played. Dirk. I don't think Dirk played college because he's from Germany.
Oh, you got the country.
Yeah, so there you
go. Okay, I'm going to ask you an unfair question.
Okay.
Name the NBA teams that Ray Allen has played for.
Oh, Ray that's Allen. That's a tough one. Miami Heat, Boston that's Celtics.
Start. That's a good start.
Did he play for the Indiana Pacers?
Similar colors. Do you want me to give you a massive hint?
Sure.
This team is no longer in the NBA.
No longer. Oh, he played for the Seattle Supersonics?
Yep. And you're missing one. I don't think you'll get this one.
No, that's the extent.
Milwaukee Bucks was the team he started out with.
Would not have gotten that.
Okay, where are you ranking Kyrie?
Let's do 5.
Love that. Love that for you. What a great take. Ooh, Marc Gasol, one of my favorite all-time players. Marc Gasol,
originally drafted by the Lakers.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Damn. Yeah. Where did he play? What was his career like?
Marc Gasol, he ended up in Memphis. I forget how he ended up in Memphis, who he was traded for.
I think he wasn't traded for his brother.
He may have been traded for his brother.
Yeah.
I can't remember that. That's as far as I've got, is him being in Memphis, though.
Won a ring with the Raptors, but anyway.
Oh, did not realize that. That's just kind of where my knowledge ended up at. Plant Ranch is saying, yep, with Kwame Brown, was traded to Memphis. So I'll do market four.
Okay, that's a good take. Your number one. Ooh, interesting. Kawhi Leonard. A frequent guest of your blind rankings.
You know, this is a solid one. I'll take it.
I think Dirk clearly is above Kawhi.
Probably.
But Kawhi's peak is peakier than Dirk's.
Correct.
Arguably.
I'll take it.
Because Dirk's finals run against the Miami Heat is a core memory. But
yeah.
So good job. That was there we you. Go. You acquitted yourself well.
I redeemed myself after Kobe 5 last week.
You redeemed yourself. I think most people would have Kyrie higher, but for reasons, he's lower.
Correct.
All right. Well, that was fun. This is a great pod. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to support the podcast, there's some really easy ways to do that. Go check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/crashthepond, and join our community. That's really what the Patreon is our community. It's our little world. So for $2 a month, you get access to our patrons-only Discord server where you get to really connect with us. We're in there all the time. We're always chatting ducks. So if you've had burning questions or things you want to ask us and you just haven't been able to get them answered on the pod, well, Discord, we're always in there. There's also a lot of different channels, you know, a lot of the football games going on. There's a great football channel in there. So that's $2 a month. You can up that pledge to $7.50 a month. With that, you get 2 bonus podcast episodes per month that are patron exclusive, and you get patron exclusive player breakdown shift by shift videos. You can't find those anywhere else. Patreon.com/crashthepond. You can also leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us there. Subscribe to us on Spotify. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. And follow us on social media. We're on Twitter. We're on Blue Sky. We're on Instagram. We are on TikTok. We have a Crash the Pond TikTok, don't we?
We do. We haven't posted there in a while, but we do.
We don't post there ever, but I'm only bringing it up because something may have been happening with TikTok. May have been
it's
in the
back.
News. I don't
it's
know.
Back.
But yeah, so follow us there and thank you for listening. We really appreciate you guys and we will talk to you next week. Have a good one.
Bye.